very much for sharing your talent with us, even when you're not the most comfortable in the world. But thank you so much. And choir, Gail also, the percussion adds so much. The year was 1939. A graduate student at UC Berkeley, George Bernard Danzig was his name. He was a graduate student in mathematics, and he was taking an advanced course in statistics. One day he was late to class. It was about 10 minutes late, and he came in to the stern look of his professor. He sat in his seat quietly, and there were three problems on the board, and he quickly copied them down while the lecture was going on. At the end of the class, he left and went home, and a day or two later, he began to work on the homework assignment. The first two problems weren't too bad. He got through those reasonably easily. But the third problem really stumped him, and he worked and he worked and he worked, and he was afraid of really not measuring up in this class. So he really poured into it. He didn't have it solved by the time the homework assignment was due, so he was late turning it in. But one afternoon, he had an inspiration, and he went and he tried it, and he solved the third problem. So a day late, he went in and he laid the, a couple days late, he turned in the assignment to the professor. Professor says, I'll throw it on the desk and I'll look at it later. He didn't think anything more about it. And about 10 days or so later, it was a Saturday morning at 7:30, there's this bang, bang, bang at the door. You know how many college kids are up at 7:30 on Saturday morning. He opened the door and there is his professor. And he thought, oh. Something's wrong here. And the professor said, I need your signature. We need a release on this. This is going to publication. He said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you solved the problem. What do you mean? It wasn't that our homework? He said, no, you missed the assignment. He said, the first two problems were your homework. The third problem was an example of an unsolvable problem. This was an example of an impossible way to do it. And you have solved it. This is something we've been with. It's been kicked around in mathematics for years, and you solved it. We're going to publication with this. It's going to be published. But you see, George Bernard Danzig didn't know it was impossible. He didn't know. It was impossible. Well, the title of my talk today is From Impossible to I'm Possible. We're going to talk about how we can step past some of the beliefs that we have of not being able to do things. We grow up believing that some things are just plain impossible. I don't know how many times I've heard it. I can't kick that addiction. I'll never shake that. It's impossible for me. Another good one is, oh, I'm not good enough for her. It's impossible for me to be with her. Or it's impossible for me to get that job. I don't have the education. I don't have the background. I don't have that. I really want that job and I'd really be great at it, but it's impossible. Or this is another one of my favorites. You can use any choice you want. Diabetes. Diabetes runs in my family. It's impossible for me to have good health. Or you can put any disease of the day you want. Runs in my family. It's impossible for me to have good health. A good example of this in our culture goes all the way back to Alice in Wonderland, where the White King at one point says, why? Sometimes I think six impossible thoughts before breakfast. And we do. We think we are impossible, that we have things that are impossible. But some of these things are not so impossible after all. In 1938, a man by the name of Paul Petzold was part of the American mountaineering and climbing team, and his mission was to climb K2, which is the second tallest mountain in the world. It's much more technically difficult than Everest. They reconnoitered the area, they decided on what the best route would be, and Paul, as the leader of the 10th Mountain Division in the U.S. Army, and his team began their ascent of K2. They didn't ever complete it in 1938. It was finally climbed in 1954. But in 1938, Paul Petzold arrived at the 22,000-foot mark and established the high base camp. What Paul Petzold didn't know was that at that time, science believed man could not live above 20,000 feet without the aid of oxygen. We just knew that wasn't possible. There wasn't enough oxygen in the air. There wasn't enough air pressure to force the oxygen into your lungs, and man could not live without, you know, additional oxygen above 20,000 feet. Well, Paul Petzold went to 22,000, lived for the next 3 weeks, and didn't have a breath of additional oxygen. He didn't know that it was impossible. Another example, and I've used this one before, but it serves us well, is Roger Bannister. You know, in that same 1954, science believed that it was impossible for man to run 15 miles an hour. It was impossible for a human being to travel 1 mile in 4 minutes. Couldn't do it. Nobody could do it. Roger Bannister ran a sub-4-minute mile. And after Roger Bannister did it, once it had been proven that it could be done, that record was broken 10 more times in the next 2 years. But we get it in our head that it's impossible. So how do we move from impossible to impossible thinking? Well, the first way is to open ourselves to a higher power. Our youth today are over there next door continuing their studies in spirituality of the indigenous people. And they are doing a great story today. And if you've got kids, ask the kids to tell you this story. They get it. And I'm just going to give you a short version of it now. But it is, all of the animals in the forest were afraid because the moose was drinking all the water. And they were afraid that they weren't going to have enough water. And they all bucked up to see who could be the one to drive the moose away. Well, all of the big animals, even the wolves and the bears, said, oh, that big moose, he's too much for us. But the little fly went from impossible to I'm possible. And the little fly said, I can drive the moose away. And he flew up his nose and he went in his eye, went in his ear, all those things that we've experienced with the mosquitoes. And finally the moose said, I've had it with this, and the moose left. The science of mind quote that they use in telling this story for the youth today, it's from our textbook, Science of Mind by Ernest Holmes. The universal mind contains all knowledge. It is the potential ultimate of all things. To it, all things are possible. To us, as much is possible as we can conceive according to law. Should all of the wisdom of the universe be poured over us, we should yet receive only that which we are ready to understand. This is why some draw one type of knowledge and some another, and all from the same source. The source, and this time he uses a capital S, the source of all knowledge. We can substitute whatever word that we choose to use for the divine and substitute it in there. Universal mind, we could call that God. God contains all knowledge. God is the potential ultimate of all things. To God, all things are possible. To us, as much as possible as we can conceive, according to law. Should all of the wisdom of the universe be poured over us, we should yet receive only that which we are ready to understand. That's why some draw one type of knowledge and some another, and all from the same source, which is God, the source of all knowledge. An example of how things can work when we are in alignment with the divine creative force of the universe can be seen of the examples of luck in science. Talked about this one before too, but it's actually a distant cousin of mine, Alexander Fleming, who is the discoverer of penicillin. He just accidentally happened to look down and see that he had some blue-green mold in a petri dish that killed all of the staphylococcus that he was trying to cultivate. And that is how penicillin was discovered. It was an accident. A guy by the name of Carl Jansky, he's with Bell Laboratories, and he was working on a project for a transatlantic radio. And this was so that the big cruise ships crossing the Atlantic, they could stay in contact with them. But in the process of that, he noticed that he was getting this strange interference. And that is how Carl Jansky discovered radio astronomy and has expanded our knowledge of the heavens a great deal. It's estimated by some people that as much as 30% of all scientific discoveries are accidental. We're working on something else and something completely different shows up. A more recent example of that, how working on one thing can result in something else, where a drug was worked on for people with a heart condition, for angina, pain in the chest and the heart from constricted heart vessels. And this new drug would expand and allow more blood to get to the heart. And it was a great success, but in a slightly different way. Today we know that drug is Viagra. The same thing worked, it just on a different organ. But they discovered that just by accident. Just yesterday, I got back from a trip and I was looking through the newspapers and I came across a really good article, and the European Space Agency, they are the ones that launched the satellite with the lander that was going to land on the asteroid. Because the lander's talons didn't grasp the asteroid well enough, it bounced. That's what they were afraid of, and it bounced and bounced and bounced because hardly any gravity. And instead of landing in the intended area, it bounced over to kind of a mountainous area, and one of its tripods that it was supposed to land on fell down, kind of down into a crack, and there it was, perched in the shadows where it could only send back transmissions for just a few short days. And then they didn't have nearly the information that they had hoped for or that they had anticipated from Philae. But because they had designed a very robust system, Philae went into a dormant state, and it preserved the batteries that it had. It just went into dormancy. Had everything worked according to schedule, Philae would have burned up on the surface of this little asteroid in December or perhaps January. But because it was tucked far away in this little crevice, now as the asteroid has gotten closer to the sun, it's starting to warm up and the batteries are working again and its solar display is catching additional sunlight. And now Philae is starting to transmit back to Earth. And not only is it transmitting at a far greater rate than they had anticipated, but because of the activity of this asteroid, they're capturing data that they couldn't have even dreamed of before. So an accident has led to another advancement in astronomy. Okay, so one of the ways that we can do this is by opening ourselves up to divine and listening to it. And one way of that is listening to the divine whisper. There is a young lady, and her name was Nita Talbot. She lived in a small town, very rural, great distance from any big cities. She was a newlywed, very excited. She worked as a hairdresser. But one day, she just got the strangest urge to learn sign language. She had no idea why, but she just had this really firm urge, conviction, that she needed to learn sign language. So she went to the little local bookstore, and the bookseller says, "No, I'm sorry, we don't have a book on sign language. We don't have any deaf people here. I could order it for you." So she didn't know what book to order, anything else, but she went ahead and ordered a book on sign language. And a few weeks later, it came in, and she started to look through it and started trying to practice a little bit. Her husband came in and asked her what in the world she was doing. She says, "I don't know. I just got this urge to learn sign language." Well, he kind of forgot about it. He didn't think it was that big of a deal. But a few days later, here she was still trying to learn it. And he said, "Why are you doing this?" And just came blurting out of her mouth. She said, "Because I think that we're going to have a deaf baby." Well, she wasn't even pregnant or anything yet. Well, a few months later, she was pregnant. And then she had a baby, and it was almost 2 months premature. But everything was fine. It had an extra week or two in the hospital, but the little baby came home. It was a darling, darling little girl named Crystal, and Crystal was beautiful and perfect in every way, including perfect hearing. So the book went into the top shelf of the closet in the very back and began to collect dust. Well, 18 months later, Crystal had a little sister, Elena. And Elena was just as beautiful and just as perfect as little Crystal. And she smiled and she cooed and just another perfect little baby. But at about month 5, one day her husband came in and he said, "I think that there's something wrong with Elena." "What do you think that might be?" I don't think she can hear." And he went in behind her little car seat that they had her sitting in, and he had a big book and he dropped it. Bang! Even little Crystal in the next room said, "Daddy, what's that?" But little Elena didn't even move. They came around to the side of her, and she was so happy to see him. She was excited visually, but she hadn't even noticed anything auditorily. So they took little Elena to their little doctor in the small town, and he examined the baby, and he said, "You're right, she is deaf, but I don't know enough about it. You're going to have to take her to the big city," which they did. The big city doctor confirmed, "Yes, she's deaf. She has a long term that I can't pronounce, but it basically said she is never going to be able to hear. She is never going to be able to hear at all." What he left Nita Talbert and her husband with was, "The most important thing for you to do right now is to communicate with this little 5-month-old. Well, they didn't know what to do, so to the top of the closet in the back and blew off the dust of the old sign language book. And once again, Nita began to learn and practice signing, and she began to work with that with this little baby. One morning she woke up and she had another one of those urges. She was just really hungry for an omelet. She was hungry for a cheese and spinach omelet, and she knew of a little restaurant that served just that. Wasn't too far away. So her husband had already gone off to his job, so she packed up the girls, and off they went to the restaurant. They were in line waiting to get a table, and a lady in front of them was a little bit older and turned around and said, "Oh, those are darling little girls. What beautiful daughters you have." She said, "Well, thank you." But Nita was secretly kind of happy when the waitress gave her a booth way in the far back, because she wasn't comfortable signing in public to her little daughter. She was sitting with her daughter and began to sign to her that mommy is getting something to eat, when she heard a whisper come from the next booth, and somebody said, "She's signing." Oh no. And then around the corner of the booth came the face of the woman that she had seen in line that had complimented her on her beautiful baby girls. And the woman said, "Where did you learn to communicate with your daughters like that?" And she said, "Well, out of a book. I didn't know what to do, and you've probably never heard of it, but I ordered this book from the bookseller, and it's helping me to do that." And the lady looked at her, and she said, "My name is Esther Zawalkow. I'm the co-author of that book. And it's not the same as standard ASL. It's, Linda can help me with this.
Signing Exact English.
Signing Exact English, S-E-E. And it is great for babies." So Nita asked Esther if she could teach her how to sign "I love you." And she showed her, what's it? Is that it? "I love you." And when we listen to those whispers, when we go out on a limb and buy a book for no reason at all, or when we go out for an omelet that makes no sense, that's when we're opening up and listening to the divine. Now, another way that we can access the divine to help us move from impossible to I'm possible is to train ourselves. Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind text says, and this is right out of our sacred reading for you who didn't make it for the sacred reading this morning, "Each should train himself, and do so consciously, to conceive of himself as a success, sailing on that boundless sea of livingness upon whose bosom we are all carried forward. We should go from success to greater success. All thoughts of failure must be erased from the mentality, and the positive thoughts of achievement should take their place. Have faith in God, in life, and in your fellow man. Know that right is might. The cosmic mind is neither wishy-washy nor willy-nilly. It is positive, certain of itself, and sure of the outcome." I can't see, compose, I guess in my brain, Ernest Holmes talking about wishy-washy and willy-nilly, but he certainly makes a beautiful point. The cosmic mind is neither wishy-washy nor willy-nilly. It is positive, certain of itself, and sure of the outcome. And that cosmic mind is God. If there is one thing that I want everybody to take away today, this idea of impossible to I'm possible. Don't tell the creative force of the universe about your big problems. Why don't you try telling your big problems about the divine creative force of the universe that is with you at this and every moment, solving those great problems? And it is that divine creative force that is with us at this and in every moment. Don't tell the creative force of the universe about your big problems. Instead, tell your big problems about the divine creative force of the universe that is conspiring with you to co-create your own good right now. And so it is with this awareness of that divine essence and presence that is within each of us at this and every moment that we turn to prayer. And I just simply in this moment recognize that there is a power in the universe. One power, one presence, one life. That life is the life of God. That life is perfect. That life is my life. That life is the life of each and every one of us here and now. And so on the behalf of each and every person that is experiencing any effect that is anything other than perfect, I know the absolute truth. For those that are experiencing lack and limitation, I know abundance. For those that are experiencing health issues, I know perfect health. For those that are experiencing separation, I simply know that we are one. And I know that the love of God runs through, around, and as each and every one of us. And I speak my word now for those in South Carolina, for those in Charleston, we are saying no to events like this, but we are saying yes to a higher expression which is emerging through and as each and every one of us right now. Globally, our hearts may be broken, not just in South Carolina, not just in the United States, but globally, our hearts may be broken. But they are broken open. They are broken open to the universal love, unconditional compassion, and a higher way of living and being in this world. And I call forth this higher way of living together in harmony in this world. And so now I just give thanks. I give thanks for my awareness of that power, that presence, that life that is God within each and every person. I give thanks for that divine compassion that we all feel. I give thanks for the love of God. Now I release these words to the working of law. I let it go. I let it be. And so it is.